You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Very interesting. The president, just gave a speech basically saying, you know, the longer I'm doing this job, the more I realize that if the American people are not with me, I'm in trouble. My words, not his, but the essence of his words. This was at the Newport News shipyard, I believe privately owned shipyard, or at least largely privatized, that, you know, builds ships for the Navy. And, you know, one of the many places where, starting on Friday this week, people are going to be laid off because of the sequester. And so the president had this to say.
In order for us to make that happen, I'm going to need you. You know, the one thing about being president is after 4 years, you get pretty humble. You'd think maybe you wouldn't, but actually you become more humble. You realize what you don't know. You realize, you know, all the mistakes you make. But you also realize you can't do things by yourself. That's not how our system works. You've got to have the help and the goodwill of Congress. And what that means is you've got to make sure that constituents of members of Congress are putting some pressure on them, making sure they're doing the right thing, putting an end to some of these political games. So I need you, Virginia, to keep up the pressure. I need you to keep up the effort. I need you to keep up the fight. If you do, Congress will listen. If you stand up and speak out, Congress will listen. And together, we will unleash our true potential, and we'll remind the world just why it is the United States builds the greatest ships on Earth and is the greatest nation on Earth.
There you go. President Obama, you know, wrapping up his speech, basically saying, you need to call your member of Congress and say, you know, enough with this sequester stuff, enough with this austerity stuff. Now, I want to dig into exactly why the Republicans are so gung-ho. Now they're even saying, oh, yeah, sequester, military, it's all fine. At least some of them are saying that. And there's an actual reason for this. It's the same reason that a group of right-wing foundations are putting John Stossel in our public schools. And when you understand the big picture about this, when you understand what's really going on, when you understand who's paying for this stuff and why, when you understand who's behind these politicians who believe that austerity is a good thing and why, then it all makes sense. By the way, the president said, constituents. I don't know if you can you hop to that place in the clip easily? I don't know. This is my one complaint about President Obama. You know, when he's speaking in public, is he, I'll bet if you walked up to 100 Americans on the street or in a shopping mall and said, please tell me the word constituent. Does it refer to something from outer space? Does it refer to a small furry animal? Does it refer to, you know, give them four or five choices. I'll bet maybe 20% of Americans know what the word constituent means. Maybe less than that. Maybe fewer than that. Of course, you know, he was saying you, the voters. What he was saying was you know, but constituent, it's a word they use inside Washington, D.C. Here he is. Come on, Mr. Obama.
You've got to make sure that constituents of members of Congress are putting some pressure on them.
No. I mean, you know, I get it. It was a brilliant speech. And you know, amen, you know, Domini, you're all Catholic. I get it. But constituent? Why not simply say you, the voter, have to contact your member of Congress and tell them that you're not happy with this and here's how you'd like to see it changed? Or words to that effect. You didn't any, but, you know, that small critique aside, here's what's really going on. There's an old cliche that nature abhors a vacuum. In a place where there needs to be something, if the thing that needs to be there isn't there, something else will step in to fill that place. Now, we need to have publicly owned roads. We need to have schools. We need to have fire departments. We need to have police departments. And the logic of the billionaires, of the monopolists, of the people who want to own everything, and by and large do. Look at industry after industry after industry in the United States, and you find duopolies, triopolies, quadopolies, two, three, four, five companies at the most owning well over 80% of all the business done in the industry. We're seeing that happen right now in the airline industry, too. American is merging with U.S. Air. United recently merged with Continental. You're going to end up with three basic, you know, basically two or three U.S. airlines who control 80% of the market. And in food, you know, you got Cargo, ConAgra, ADM, rather. In fast food, you've got, you know, the company that owns, Pepsi, whatever it is, Brands Co., whatever, that owns Burger King. And I don't have a list, but 80,000 different magazines and newspaper titles owned by six companies in the media. Ben Bagdikian documents this brilliantly in his book, The Media Monopoly. Pick a sector. Defense. I mean, pick a sector. What you will find is that a small number of people basically own that sector. So the monopolists who want to own everything, they are basically fronting libertarian propaganda. Libertarian is a fancy way of saying we want what the billionaires want. Get rid of government. And if you get rid of government, who's going to fill that space? I mean, the billionaires are sitting around going, or some of them, not all, obviously not all of them, but the libertarian billionaires are sitting around saying to themselves, look at all these people driving on these public roads. I could be making a nickel every time somebody drives by that corner right there. If I could just put an RFID chip in their car and have a little meter on the corner and call it a privatized road, charge them. Every time somebody, the light goes from red to green to save lives so you don't have car crashes, I should make a buck or a penny. Fire calls, fire departments. Hey, if a fire department's going to put somebody, I should be making some money off this thing. Police services. I mean, now they're doing this, right? Privatized prisons. And what comes along with privatized prisons? More laws. Now we need to create some more criminals. So the libertarian agenda, pure and simple, is the economic royalist agenda. It is the agenda of the hard right billionaires who want to own everything. And the more that they can shrink government, the more that they can destroy government, the more that they can diminish the role of government in our lives, the more they can step in and be that force, be that power, and make a buck off it. And just like we know, I mean, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, Veterans Administration, all of these government medical programs, for example, run on anywhere from a 1 to a 4% overhead for administration and basically everything. Private health insurance, minimum 20, and in many cases as much as 30, 35, 40% overhead. Why? Because, say, it's privatized. Somebody's got to make a buck. You got to pay dividends to the stockholders. That's 10% off the top. You got to pay the CEO his $1 billion. You got to pay all the, you know, United Healthcare. You got over 100 people making over $1 million a year. I mean, yeah, got to skim that money off the top. So it gets pretty simple. These guys who are out there preaching the libertarian agenda are simply preaching the agenda of the libertarian billionaires who want to own everything. That's the essence of this whole anti-government thing. And that's why the Republicans like the sequester. I'll explain more and tell you about John Stossel after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, you heard me right, John Stossel. He is now coming to a school near you. Your head is going to explode when you hear what he's telling school kids. Okay, so I started laying this thing out. The reason, and let me just repeat it, very, very quickly, and then bring you up to speed with John Stossel. There is a reason that goes beyond just you know, this philosophical notion, this libertarian philosophical notion that people should be allowed to smoke pot and gay people should be allowed to get married, which, you know, is like the libertarians. This is the stuff where the billionaires say, hey, it doesn't matter to me. In fact, I could probably make a buck off it. Right? Gay people getting married? I own all the marriage concessions in the state. So, more money. People smoking pot? Hey, we can just start, you know, I mean, we did it with the tobacco companies. We can do it with the alcohol companies. There's money to be made. So, not that I'm opposed to either of those positions, by the way. I mean, you know, but that my point is that it's very fashionable right now among young people to say, I'm a libertarian, in large part because of those two positions, because the Republicans are not taking those positions and the Democrats are not taking those positions. And so who's left? The Green Party obviously, you know, holds those positions, but the Green Party is about things like also let's strengthen the EPA. And there's not hundreds of millions of dollars, literally hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of billions or maybe even hundreds of billions of dollars behind the Green Party. But there is millions, hundreds of millions of dollars behind the libertarian efforts. Because they will make more money for billionaires. The more you can destroy government, the more you can make people hate government, the more you can make people mistrust government, which is, you know, when you think about it, a fundamentally un-American thing. We fought and died for this government. For 240 years since the Boston Tea Party this year, this November, 240 years since the first serious rebellion in the United States. And Americans have been fighting and dying and working to preserve this country. This is our country. And these libertarians are coming along taking the position of, oh, yeah, but it's a bad thing. Now, why do they say that? Because if you can get government out of the business of anything, fill in the blanks, it means that there's an opportunity for somebody to step in and make a buck off it. Now, in some cases, that's entirely appropriate. I don't think the government should be making my blue jeans. I don't want the government making my shirt. I don't want the government making my computer. I used to live in a country next door to a country, and West Germany, next door to East Germany, where the government made the cars, the Trebbies. Boy, were they terrible. Little two-cycle engines that blew smoke out the back and sounded like a bad washing machine. I don't want the government doing those things. You know, I believe regulated capitalist economy in a democratic socialist government, which is pretty much what we had from the 1940s until the 1980s. And it's pretty much what, you know, the other developed countries of the world have. But the libertarian billionaires don't like that. They want to figure out a way to make a buck off everything. Water. Everybody needs water. Let's privatize it. Sewage disposal. Everybody has, you know, everybody produces waste. Ah, let's privatize it. Electricity. We need electricity. Ah, let's privatize it and centralize it. What? Solar panels on every roof? No, no, no. Let's even pass laws that say you can't feed back into the grid. Safety issues, you know. Right. So the sequestration is the latest in the austerity attempts. And as the president is correctly pointing out, government is the government of the United States, the government sector, actually, because state and local governments are really, you know, they're kind of echoing out the federal government. The federal government controls and manufactures and makes the U.S. dollars. States, every state in the union has a requirement in its constitution, with the exception of Vermont, has a requirement in its constitution that they maintain a balanced budget. Now, many states get around that by floating bonds and then, you know, moving those bonds down into future generations or future administrations. But the bottom line is states can't print money. So if you can cut federal programs to the states are going to have to cut their local programs. And so when you add it all together, you aggregate the whole thing, federal and state and local, all of that government spending represents about 20% of our economy, $1 in $5. Now, if you and I ran a business, let's say we had started the Acme Widget Company, we're selling a lot of, whatever. Light bulb company. Let's make it more real. Let's make some really cool LED light bulbs. And we're selling them. And we must be selling some of them wholesale because we got one customer who's buying 20% of what we're selling. So that's a lot. And our customer all of a sudden starts buying 2-3% less stuff from us. Now tell me how that's supposed to make our business grow. Yet that's the argument the Republicans are making. If the government spends less, in other words, buys fewer things in the private economy, because that's who the government buys from. When the government buys something, they don't buy it from themselves. They buy it from entrepreneurs, business, you know, other businesses, right? So when the government cuts back on spending, how is that supposed to help the economy? The biggest customer is going away. The biggest customer is cutting back on their spending. Of course, it doesn't help the economy. What it does is it hurts government, throws more people into poverty, makes more people upset with government, which is fertile ground for libertarians and these right-wing Republicans, to sow their, let me tell you, the wonders of the billionaires story. And now they're funding John Stossel to come into the schools and tell our children climate change. There ain't no climate change. I'll play that clip for you right after the break at the bottom of the hour, and then we can talk about this on the telephone if you'd like. But this is, there is an agenda here. There is a libertarian billionaire agenda that is being played out, and this the sequestration debate and all of these budget debates and all of these we've got a spending problem, all of this nonsense, this we've got a spending problem nonsense, and it really is. It's a lie. We don't have a spending problem. We spend a fraction of what most fully developed nations spend. All of it has to do with making a buck for the oligarchs. For the billionaires.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And not even all the billionaires, but specifically for the billionaires who are willing to hustle and trade in the commodity of what should be the public sphere. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Jeff Sessions, this is mind-boggling. I mean, this is the extent to which these guys go. We're talking about this whole privatization agenda. The government shouldn't do it. It should be the private health insurance companies that are doing it. It should be the private, you know, fill in the blanks. It should be the private prisons that are doing it. It should be the private fire departments. It should be the private school. It's all about somebody should make a buck off it, right? And Senator Jeff Sessions has, I think Progress is calling it, launched the most dishonest attack against Obamacare you've ever heard. I'm going to play just a little tiny clip of this. You can take this out of my computer, right, Shano? Here we go.
The new government report dramatically proves that the promises made, assuring the nation that the largest new entitlement program in history since Medicare, the president's health care program, would not add a dime to the long or short-term debt of America was false.
It proves it was false. Well, actually, this new government report, Jeff Sessions went to the government accountability office, and the GAO and said, would you please prepare a report that summarizes what would happen if Obamacare goes fully into effect, but the cost containment part of Obamacare... It's actually this it's called the Independent Payment Advisory Board. The Independent Payment Advisory Board, which basically makes sure that the health insurance companies, since Obamacare is based in private corporate health insurance, right, for-profit health insurance, the Independent Advisory Board oversees this to make sure they don't rip us off. What would happen if you got rid of that board? Please tell me. And so the GAO says, okay, here's the math. If you get rid of the board, it's going to cost more. And then Jeff Sessions goes on the floor of the Senate and says, I have in my hands a government report proving Obamacare is going to cost more. I mean, these are the kind of lies. There's no other way to call it. Lies and deceptions that these right-wingers are promulgating. Why? So that the people who own them, and make no mistake about it, Jeff Sessions is owned. The people who own these politicians can make more money. It's all about the money. $400 million coming out of the hard rights Dark Money ATM is what Media Matters is referring to it as. You can see this over at MediaMatters.org. Donors Trust and Donors Capital Fund, they write. The affiliated funding groups were until recently obscure entities, but over the last month, a series of reports have detailed how these organizations have paid out more than $400 million to over 1,000 conservative groups since their 1998 founding. One of those is called Stossel in the Classroom. Founded with Koch money as the libertarian, this is from CIT, has taken this thing over, which is the Philadelphia-based Center for Independent Thought, CIT, right. Funded with Koch lib money as the Libertarian Review Foundation in the 70s, real estate developer Howard Rich took control of the organization in 1990, gave it its current name. He also founded Americans for Limited Government, sits on the board at Cato, the Club for Growth, Friedman Center for Educational Choice, and his wife runs CIT. So what is John? So what these guys are doing basically is they're producing videos that go to schools. They're running contests where you can be one of the students who win one of 225 cash prizes, totaling $23,000, which doesn't sound like a whole lot of money in the whole grand scheme of things. But when you're talking about 10-year-olds, you know, earning a $100 prize, a $300 prize, earning an all-expenses-paid trip to New York City to be on John Stossel's show, this is big stuff. And here he is. Here's John Stossel on his – and this is from one of the videos that goes into the classrooms. At least if – assuming that I'm reading this Media Matters report correctly, you will find it on their – you'll find this clip on their page over at MediaMatters.org. In this article titled How the Right's Dark Money ATM Spent $1 Million on Stossel Educational Materials. Here he is shilling for the carbon industry, for the big oil industry, the big coal industry, and the fracking and gas industry, who are devastating our planet via global warming by producing carbon dioxide emissions. And here's John Stossel saying, global warming? Hey, it's still being debated. We don't know the science. Come on. Well, actually, you can listen for yourself. Here he is.
Some scientists say the warming may be caused by changes in the sun or ocean currents or changes in cloud cover.
Or other things we don't understand. The debate is not over. And anyway, who's to say that yesterday's temperature was the perfect one?
Some scientists say. Huh. How about that? Some scientists are wondering if several things come to mind, but probably not good to say on the radio about John Stossel. So I'll just leave it at that. The point is that there's a reason why these billionaires are funding Stossel. There's a reason why they're funding all this libertarian stuff. There's a reason why, you know, we're going to be doing CPAC shortly, the Conservative Political Action Conference. And when you watch those pictures of CPAC and you see the media coverage, one of the things you have to know is that some very large percentage, the vast majority, I don't know if it's 70, 80, 90%, but some very large percentage of the people who are there are these well-scrubbed, attractive young people. People in their late teens, early 20s in particular, mid-20s, early 30s in some cases. But, you know, the average age, I've done CPAC for 6 years now, I think, in a row. The average age seems to be around 20, 22, something like that. A lot of young people. And I remember the first couple of years I was there just marveling, saying, wow, I wish, you know, you go to these progressive events and you see a bunch of baby boomers, a bunch of people in their 50s and 60s and 40s maybe, and young people, you know, the Occupy people. But, you know, where is the large? But there they are. See, well, it turns out that the billionaires fund, you know, Young Republicans for Freedom and Young Republicans groups and this Republican group and that Republican group and this conservative group and libertarian groups all over the country. And they have contests and you too can win, a week in Washington, D.C., all expenses paid, and go to the CPAC conference. In other words, they're packing the room. Been doing it for years. never reported in the press. Why are they doing this? Because if they can get us to think that government is bad, that what George Washington fought and died for, this republic right here, the United States of America, if they can get people to think that our small, our Republican form of government is a bad thing, that it can't do things right, then the commons can be privatized and they can make a buck off it. And just look at the classic example, just look at what's happening with the private prisons. These private prisons are hell holes. You look at some of the reports on these things, the abusive situation, but they're profitable. Sure, you can run it for less than the public prison runs for. You can, but how do you do that? Well, you pay Walmart wages. You hire people with, you know, no job security, no pension, and no accountability. Have incredible turnover. Bad, lousy food. No concept. I mean, you know, what's the whole purpose of a prison? It's not just to punish people, it's to rehabilitate people. It's to get people functional so that they can go back into society. Well, why would a private prison give a rat's patootie about that? You can't make a buck doing that. In fact, if anything, if you can turn out people, if when they leave prison, they're more likely to come back into prison, if you can have an increased recidivism rate, you make more money. It's all about the money. This is so fundamentally anti-American. Libertarianism, at its core, is anathema to the values upon which this republic was founded. Read the preamble to the Constitution. It's very, very straightforward. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice. This is not, here they are. They're laying out the commons. Establish justice. Ensure domestic tranquility. Let's make it work. Provide for the common defense. Promote the general welfare, and welfare is capitalized. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Very straightforward. But if you can get people to believe that, oh, you know, this is nonsense, you know, it's Joe McCarthy told us we don't live in a democracy, we live in a republic, because it sounds more like Republican. Democracy sounds like Democratic. Actually, it's both. You know, it's constitutionally limited, representative Democratic Republic. But you can get people to believe in stuff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can just take these suckers down the road and convince them the government can't do anything right and create even more opportunities for Enron. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Dominic in Argyle, New York. You want to disagree with me, Dominic?
Yeah, Tom, I listen a lot, and I like a lot of what you say. And
but
you just made a comment earlier today and yesterday. One of the comments you made today was that you're all for a democratic socialist government, and you're calling the libertarians anti-American. And I won't get in that debate because I don't agree with a lot of what they say, but this government was not set up as a socialist government.
You sure was. We have a military. We have a post office. We have educational systems. George Washington signed the first law that provided for housing, food, and clothing for poor people in Washington, D.C. We've been a socialist government from the founding of the republic.
The socialism was vehemently debated and pushed through, much like a lot of the legislation gets pushed through, not only on a state level, but on a federal level, where it's being done in a disadvantaged way.
What are you talking about, Dominic?
Genuous way. Well, I'm talking about examples of that are to have the legislatures and or assembly meet in late hours and pushing bills through that have
rises. What does that have to do with a system of governance where the commons are administered by the government rather than by corporations? That when I talk about democratic socialism as opposed to old Union of Soviet Socialist Republics kind of socialism, you know, which really should be called communism. I am not an advocate of communism. What I'm talking about is the government, we the people, being administered by our elected representatives, because we have a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic here in this country, that when our government administers the commons, the things that we all collectively own, because all of them are too big for any of us individually to do it for ourselves unless we happen to be billionaires. Things like our educational system, our fire departments, our schools, our military. That is the definition of democratic socialism.
Okay, so that's what you meant. Okay, that's fine.
Now, by socialism, you're talking about the Soviet Union or Cuba or something where the government's making your jeans and your car and your computer. I've already said I don't want that.
Okay, and I just want to point out some of the areas that we're heading in. You mentioned yesterday about the billionaires tax. Let's tax anything over a billion at 100%.
Yeah.
The caution is this. This was the first round, and much of the stimulus package that was passed, I agreed with. But this was the first round where I believe the government stepped into a real muddy area in buying corporations. Buying them with the hopes of selling them back, but buying them.
You're talking about GM? You're talking about bailing out GM?
Not the bailout, not necessarily. Well, that in and of itself had some real.
That's the only one that I know of. And that was by law, that stock could only be held for a short period of time. And there was a unique type of stock that was created to make it happen. And you know, the company had to go through a bankruptcy to make that happen. There is, to the best of my knowledge, zero attempts on the part of this government now or at any point in its history to socialize what should be in the private sector. Now, the debate, of course, is where is that line drawn? Where does the commons end and the private sector begin? Right. And I'm of the opinion that, you know, for example, half of all the electricity generated in the United States is generated by publicly owned utilities. In other words, government run utilities. Half of it is owned by private utilities. You know, corporations making a buck. When you look at the difference between the two, what you find is that the publicly owned utilities tend to be in better shape. They're better maintained. Their rates are lower. They're more responsive to their local ratepayers. The privately owned ones tend to be the ones that are creaky and cranky and falling apart and loaded with debt, and they're more likely to be ripping off ratepayers. Why? Because they're run for a buck. They're not run for the public interest. You only have one electric wire coming into your house. It's a natural monopoly. Shouldn't it be part of the commons?
Yes, it should. Absolutely.
Okay. So you're starting to sound like a socialist.
Well, no. But except that, when you look at all the taxes, the excise taxes that are attached to that, it becomes exorbitant.
And what are you talking about? If you're buying your electricity from your own local government and you're electing the people who are on the board that are running that, and you can vote the bums off if you don't like the way it's done, where's the taxes? I don't get it. You pay your electric bill.
Well, here again, if those taxes are attached to a bill that is buried 15,000 pages down, you have no idea who has even sponsored.
You know, Dominic, the people who are hysterical about taxes are the very, very, very rich.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm hysterical at all.
I'm saying that they have been promoting this tax hysteria to the point that average working class people and middle class people are, and even poor people. Are hysterical about taxes, and it's absurd. It's just absolutely absurd. The United States is not an overtaxed country. We're paying about 19% of our net in the cost in taxes and in the cost of doing business government. Now, if you the one argument that you could make is that individuals are overtaxed relative to history. If you go back and you look during the Eisenhower administration, about a third of all federal tax collections came from corporations. About 15% of all tax collections came in the form of tariffs. You know, the taxes on international trade, that's down to about 1%. The corporate part is down to about 11%. And guess who picked up the slack? You and me.
Absolutely. And when we say we're overtaxed, we're also talking about not just the taxes that are put in the form of a tax, like a federal tax or an estate tax and so on and so forth, but there are a lot of fees and levies that we have to
sure.
pay, and those are taxes.
But if they're paying for something, for example, if you pay, you know, $50 to get your driver's license, and it actually costs $50 to have somebody sit there and administer the driver's license test and print out that piece of plastic, isn't that reasonable?
It's difficult to get anything to you because the moment somebody opens their mouth with a sentence, you jump right in with your thought. But I hear
what?
You.
Okay. That was kind of a yes or no question.
I think it's
reasonable.
You know, it's,
I got to say, Dominic, I think it's reasonable. But you know, I didn't turn on the music. It just automatically starts at 57 minutes past the hour. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Speaking of conservative think tanks, there's the Manhattan Institute, manhattan-institute.org, and Diana Furchgott-Roth is with us. She is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Diana, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be with you.
You wrote a piece suggesting that President Obama, specifically, I'm assuming that you really mean Congress because they appropriate funds and spend them. The executive branch just kind of administers the spending, but that the headline is Obama must drop green energy for real energy. Do you want to give us the essence of that?
So the essence of it is that there's a lot of subsidies for green energy, about $12 billion a year. And what this does is it makes electricity more expensive rather than less expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Wind and solar cost more than natural gas to produce a given unit of electricity. And so what I'm suggesting is that now that we have the sequester looming in front of us, that might be one place to cut. It's $12 billion a year of tax expenditures and different grants. And I have in front of me a report by the Inspector General of the Department of Energy saying that the Department of Energy's management of the award of $150 million Recovery Act grant to LG Chem in Michigan was mishandled. It's true of other grants also.
Okay. So really there's two issues, it seems, here. One is, why is it that in the United States green energies, renewable energies, specifically wind and solar, are more expensive than natural gas, coal, or oil, whereas in Australia they are less expensive because and in China soon they will be less expensive. Because those countries have actually decided that they're going to charge the industry for the externalities. In other words, right now, oil, gas, and coal are not really less expensive. It's just that all the costs associated with them, all the cancers that are caused, all the damage to the environment that's caused, all those giant pits of fly ash, you know, all the exhaust pipe problems, all those are paid for by us through our tax dollars in other ways. You know, we pay for hospital visits and we pay for Hurricane Sandy cleanup and like that. So the Australians said, okay, we're going to put a tax on carbon. And now in Australia, the least expensive forms of electricity are those generated by solar and wind. So why don't we do that? Well, first of all, why is it that we are continuing to subsidize the fossil fuel industry?
Well, I would argue that we're not subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. We're giving them the same tax structure as others.
No, they're not paying for their externalities.
Which externalities are you referring to?
Their pollution. They are not paying for that. When the fossil fuel industry, throws carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and it alters our planet's troposphere, it all alters our weather ultimately. They're not paying a penny for that. When they put high fractions, the benzenes and whatnot, all the zines into the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels, particularly gasoline, And people get cancer, and it's 20, 30, 40,000 cancers a year that can fairly clearly be linked to that. They're not paying a penny of any of that stuff. You know, Denmark actually did the math on this and came to the conclusion that there was about $5.50 in externalities associated with every gallon of gasoline. And they put that on as a gasoline tax, which is why gasoline in Denmark is among the most expensive in the world. It's a little over $10 a gallon. And the Danes drive a lot less. And then, and they're, you know, they're generating all their electricity, or not all their electricity, 18%, as of about 4 years ago. They're shooting for 36% by the end of the next decade from the wind towers in Copenhagen Harbor and other places. That's why the Germans have solar panels, you know, in every second or third house all over Germany.
Germany's just given up its subsidies for solar because they found it's not cost efficient.
That's not true. They gave up their subsidies for solar because there's so much solar electricity being produced. Their initial goal had been 3 gigawatts. When they surpassed 10 gigawatts, the average German households were producing so much electricity through solar that their grid couldn't handle it. Now they've got to retool over the next decade. They got to build a smart grid to be able to handle all this electricity that they're developing with all the solar power. I've been there. We did our show from there. I had the German minister on who put the program together. He just died last year.
Oh, well, that's too bad. I'm very sorry to hear it, especially since he was responsible for a successful solar program. But to get back to electricity costs, what we're talking about is natural gas. Natural gas pollutes very little. Second, carbon.
Fracking pollutes very little?
Natural gas.
Natural gas comes from fracking, or much of it comes from fracking, which is leaving hundreds of millions of gallons of highly toxic waste all over the United States. And again, the natural gas companies are not paying for this stuff. They're not paying for those for the cost of that pollution to present and future generations. They're not paying for their externalities.
Well, I would argue that it's not highly toxic waste. It's fracking is a safe technology. The aquifer is separated from the shale gas, and it has brought the cost of natural gas down, which is a benefit to the United States. Natural gas is now $3.50 per million BTUs. It's attracting back businesses from all over the world in terms of petrochemicals.
It is cheap
because our energy is
because all the rest of us are paying for the costs, the externalities associated.
Well, our air has been getting steadily cleaner over the past 20 or 30 years, and we could have pure, completely pure air if we did not have any kind of technology at all. If we just went back to being cavemen, is that what you want, Tom?
No. What I would like to see is I would like to see us do like Australia has done and put a tax on these carbons, these carbon products, so that we can capture these externality costs and have a real apples to apples comparison of the cost
of
producing
energy. Well, you have to realize that it makes energy more expensive. That also has downsides.
It's already more expensive. It's just that we're paying for it in different ways. We're paying for it. I'm paying extra income taxes to cover the hospitalization of people who got cancer from auto exhaust. Shouldn't the oil companies be paying for that?
Evidence that people get cancer from auto exhaust. And the air is getting cleaner as new cars replace old cars. The air is getting steadily cleaner. And interestingly enough, asthma is going up rather than down. One benefit they say of cleaner air is we'll have less asthma.
Well, the asthma seems to be going up.
More asthma.
In large part, I mean, you know, there's the hygiene hypothesis. That's a whole different argument.
Yes, our regulations,
the EPA, these fine government regulations have resulted in somewhat cleaner air, assuming that you're not considering carbon dioxide a pollutant.
I think we've kind of tax oil companies. Maybe you should tax farmers because their animals emit carbon. They emit greenhouse gases too.
But those greenhouse gases are not greenhouse gases that were captured 600 million years ago and are only now being released. They're greenhouse gases that were captured a year ago or 2 years ago when those soybeans or that corn was grown and are now being released. So it's a very short cycle. Therefore, the externalities are virtually zero.
I think that basically the question is how much tax we want to have, how much cost we want to impose on ourselves, and also for what purpose.
Well, I'm saying we're already paying for this.
Are you inviting me on your program? Do you want me to talk or you just want to talk?
I think we should both talk.
Okay, well then, it used to be that people would say that we should have solar and wind for two purposes. First of all, we need to be energy independent. Secondly, we would lower global warming. Now it's been shown that China and India are not cutting back on their emissions. So for us to cut back on our carbon emissions is just cutting off our noses to spite our faces. We're not going to have any difference to global.
That is the weakest
climate.
Argument you have.
No, it's a very
bad people next door. The guy next door is beating his wife. I should be able to, too.
China produces most of its electricity through coal. We are exporting it to China, so we are actually losing business to China because they have less expensive energy. We would be damaging ourselves. We are damaging ourselves, putting in place solar and wind, making electricity more expensive, cutting off job creation in the United States.
On that, I will leave you with the last word. Diana Furchot Roth, Senior Fellow with the Manhattan Institute, manhattan-institute.org. Thank you for dropping by. Hello? Oh, she's gone. All right. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we never did get to the issue of, you know, is this a good investment? I want to riff on that a little bit in just a minute. One of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. A free signed copy of Unequal Protection will be sent using stamps.com, and that caller could be you if you tickle Shano's fancy. So keep an ear open. Okay, so the two arguments that Diana made, and I'm not going to... I'm going to stop referring to her as a guest at this point because she's not here to defend herself, and I really try not to jump on people when they're not here to defend themselves. So let me make this far more generic. The two main arguments that are made against our government providing subsidies to new industries. And in fact, Shano, if there's a copy of Rebooting the American Dream around here, could you toss it to me if you can find a copy? Because I would like to share with my listeners, with our listeners, what Alexander Hamilton said. Thank you, sir. What Alexander Hamilton said about this. I'm not exaggerating. This is, you know, and he could have just as easily have been talking about, here we go. This is from Alexander Hamilton's 11-point plan for American manufacturers. Item number one, protecting duties. We call these tariffs, right? Item number two, prohibition of rival articles or duties equivalent to prohibitions. Obviously, you know, this is all about stopping the importation. Item number three, prohibitions of the exportation of the materials of manufacture. In other words, don't sell your raw materials overseas. Keep them. But here's where it gets interesting. Number four, pecuniary bounties. Pecuniary meaning, of course, money. And I'll read to you. This has been found one of the most efficacious means of encouraging manufacturers, and it is in some views the best, though it has not yet been practiced upon by the government of the United States, unless the allowance on the exportation of dried and pickled fish and salt meat could be considered as a bounty. And though it is less favored by public opinion than some other modes, its advantages are these. A, so basically what he's talking about is government support for solar energy. Back then, it was government support for a domestic shipbuilding industry. Literally. You know, we don't have a shipbuilding industry. Let's help, you know, let's give some money to a private company to start one. Number one, it is a species of encouragement more positive and direct than any other, and for that very reason has a more immediate tendency to stimulate and uphold new enterprises, increasing the chances of profit and diminishing the risks of loss in the first attempts. This is Alexander Hamilton, 1793. I'm reading it to you word for word, unedited. From my this is my book, Rebooting the American Dream. Number two, it avoids the inconvenience of a temporary augmentation of price. In other words, we could buy our green energy cheaper because it's being subsidized by the government. It avoids the inconvenience of a temporary augmentation of price, which is incident to some other modes, or it produces to a less degree, either by making no addition to the charges on a rival foreign article, as in the case of protecting duties, or by making a smaller addition. In other words, this is another way of keeping our domestically produced stuff inexpensive for our consumers. The first happens when the fund for the bounty is derived from a different object, other words, let's tax oil and use it to pay for solar power. The first happens when the fund for the bounty is derived from a different object, which may or may not increase the price of some other article according to the nature of that object. The second, when the fund is derived from the same or a similar object of foreign manufacture. A 1% duty on the foreign article converted into a bounty on the domestic. In other words, you're going to subsidize the domestic instead of taxing the foreign. Will have an equal effect of a duty of 2% exclusive of such a bounty, and the price of the foreign commodity is liable to be raised in the one case in the proportion of 1%, in the other that of 2%. Indeed, and, you know, he goes on and on, because this is written in the language of the 1700s, and so in any case. Oh, and number 11, the facilitation of the transportation of commodities. This is another. I mean, it's the government subsidies. So this is Alexander Hamilton says we should have government subsidies. We did, and George Washington agreed with him and put them into place in 1793. And we still have them today. There are industries in a big way in the late 1890s, we started subsidizing the oil industry because we saw it as a vital industry. It's driving the Industrial Revolution. And then, of course, John Rockefeller had his lobbyists. We're still subsidizing the oil industry. Well, maybe it was a good idea in the 1890s. I mean, it did build the biggest industrial economy in the history of the world. I don't think it's a good idea anymore. We should be using that money to subsidize something else. So anyhow, the two arguments that these folks make are, number one, fossil fuels are cheaper. Well, actually, no, they're not. If you consider the cost of the externalities, the cost of the cancers and the asthmas and the global warming and the fracking fluids and the coal fly ash behind the power plants and the dead miners, consider all this, they're not cheaper. But the other argument that they make is government should not be in the business of booting industries, of starting things up. To which I would say, okay, December 6, 1957. United States, why, by the way, they say, oh, because Solyndra failed. That solar company that we were going to help out, it failed. December 6, 1957, the United States' first attempt to launch a satellite into orbit was also its first failure. 10 seconds after, or 2 seconds after leaving the launch pad at Cape Canaveral, the rocket lost thrust, sank back down, blew up because of the fuel tanks. Well, that didn't work so well. Okay, let's give it up. We don't need to be a space power. Or April 4th, 1968, Apollo 6. The first unmanned test of the Saturn V rocket. It blew up. Oh, well, that doesn't work. The early ARPANET, it didn't work. We couldn't get computers to talk to each other. They had to develop TCP/IP in order to make it work, because it didn't work, because there were different computers and different operating systems. Should we have just said, screw it. You know, the mail works. You want to send a paper to somebody else? Forget about ARPANET and then DARPANET and all that stuff. You know, the early internet, which was all government. Use the post office.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We don't need to be subsidizing no new industries. You know, space, internet, come on. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Okay. I think I've laid this out fairly straightforward. It was government funding that cured, well, an awful lot of diseases. A lot, you know, I know, for example, that one of the anti-cancer drugs that Louise is, you know, took as part of her chemotherapy was initially developed as part of a government grant. Work on a whole variety of things has been government funded. Our space program, I just don't get this. These two arguments. Number one, fossil fuels are cheap, so let's just go with them. All right, horses are cheap. Let's do away with cars. Well, actually, that's not a good analogy. But it's not really cheap, is the point. And number two, why are we picking winners and losers? Well, because we want a good outcome. As Alexander Hamilton suggested in his letter to Congress and General and President George Washington in 1791, he wrote it, Hamilton's Report on Manufactures. You want to read it? I mean, you can find it on the internet. It's free. I've boiled it down, and it's republished in my book, Rebooting the American Dream as well. Pretty straightforward stuff. Anthony, Cleveland, Ohio, you're concerned that the Libertarian Party, when Charles Koch ran for president on the Libertarian ticket, you don't have any recollection of that.
I'm 43. I don't actually, but
I think it was 1980.
I guess the one point I want to make at this point is, and we're going to have to agree to disagree by the end of the call, because I doubt we're going to convince each other. But, you know, one thing you need to understand about libertarians is we are distrusting of billionaires as you are. It's just the solution for how to rein them in, so to speak, is categorically different.
Then why does the Reason Foundation, which publishes the principal libertarian magazine, get their money from billionaires? Right. Why does the Cato Institute, the principal libertarian think tank, get their, it used to be called the Charles H. Koch Foundation, or David H. Koch, whatever it was. Why do they get their money from billionaires? Why is the billionaires are funding virtually all of the major libertarian organizations?
Are you under some delusion that the billionaires do not fund the Democratic Party? Are you under some delusion that that billionaires did not fund the
No, I do not think that the Koch brothers are funding the Democratic Party at all. I think that they're funding in part the Republican Party.
Other billionaires.
Pardon?
Are you under some delusion that billionaires did not write Obamacare, that Big Pharma did not write Obamacare? Are you under that delusion? Okay. I can tell you, I can assure you that if you go to a Libertarian Party meeting, I guarantee you there's going to be no billionaires there. And I guarantee you the budget of our party, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, waste more money on swizzle sticks than we have. We get no money from corporate funding because they want no part of the free market. Plain and simple.
Sure. Yeah. You're probably right. You know, it would be a great strategy. If I was the Koch brothers, who have been funding libertarian causes since the 70s, probably before then. I mean, Daddy Fred, you know, the John Birch Society was kind of the early
exception that proves the rule.
Yeah. Well, if I was them, I would say, okay, let's fund the think tanks so we get the ideas out there. Let's fund the high-profile media spokespeople, and I can tell you I know that they're getting funded. They come on my program and are paid to do very well, thank you very much, to do so, not by me. And let's fund the publications, and then let the organizations kind of fund themselves and have bake sales and think that they're independent.
The Libertarian Party, is independent of the institutions you mentioned. Why a certain billionaire may want to fund the Reason Foundation? It's not per se bad.
Because libertarianism makes more money for billionaires. That's why they don't fund the Democratic Party.
Actually, incorrect. That would be incorrect. Libertarian philosophy makes less money for billionaires. Actually, the last thing they want.
How?
Okay, I'll explain how. The last thing any billionaire wants is an unregulated free market that insists that they produce the best product at the cheapest possible price and gives them no exception. What they want is a government that they can buy off and then allow them to produce a substandard product and then create obstacles for new entries from competing with them. They want no part of the free market, which is why we never see a penny of corporate money.
Okay, I get it. You believe this stuff, Anthony. Let's walk through it, okay? Let's just step through it, and maybe you can convince me.
You would be a fine defender of individual liberty.
Great. Let's say that you and I and Shano, our associate producer, Jim Javinsky, our associate producer doing our video, that each one of us are in the business in a competing industry. Let's say that all four of us have little oil refineries, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we're all competing to produce a better product. And there is no government regulation whatsoever. It's a wide open market.
Correct. Well, and, there's regulation, but it's not government regulation. The free market will regulate
it. Right. The free market is regulating it. Okay.
Yes.
And so people are buying my gasoline or Shano's or mm-hmm. David's or yours based on price, on quality, on convenience, on location.
There you go. Okay.
And I'm doing pretty well. And so I decide to buy Shano's company from him.
Okay.
Okay. And so now he's no longer competing with me. And just all that's left is you and Jim. And so then I buy out Jim's company. And now my company is three times bigger than your company. I can do three times as much advertising. I can you know, ring fence you, basically. I can make sure that this is, and if you're old enough, you remember back in the 60s and 70s, the growth strategy for Standard Oil was whenever, as I recall, it was Standard, it was one of the major oil companies, whenever there is a gas station that's successful on a corner, you put one on the opposite corner. Right.
Okay.
And that's why there used to be corners where there were four gas stations on, you know, on the corners for throughout most of the 60s. So this was their growth strategy. And it was really a monopoly strategy. It was put the competitors out of business until you own the market. And eventually I squeeze you out of business, too.
Okay.
And I'm left the only one in the marketplace. What keeps me now, being the only person in the marketplace? I own all the oil wells, I own all the oil, I own all the refineries. What keeps me from jacking the price up or stinking up the air?
Okay, well, this is my response. In reality, what you're talking about was attempted. Standard Oil did attempt to do that back in the earlier part of
and government stopped
the 20th century. No. Government helped them insinuate their monopoly. What prevents you from going along with your example, what would prevent you from doing that is the free market. As long as the ease of entry back into the market is cheap, the competitors will always be there. What Standard Oil found out is when they were doing this process of buying out all these competing companies, the price of the oil kept dropping, and they could not keep out the competitors until they went to the government and said, help us keep out the competitors.
But Anthony, I read several histories of the Standard Oil Company when I was writing my book on equal protection. I've got a chapter
the
on them.
Time
on
they built up their monopoly, the price of the oil kept dropping, and that's the important item.
The price, John Rockefeller was dropping the price of oil in order to drive his competitors out of business in Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania, and then he was colluding with the railroads to refuse to carry their oil, and when they went bankrupt, he was buying them up. And the state of Ohio was so horrified by this that they began to prosecute him. And when Ohio said this is a trust that he's created by buying all these companies, he's basically creating a monopoly. They called them trusts back then. Rockefeller said, and this was in the late 1780s, early 1790s, what's referred to as the charter mongering era. Look it up. He said, what state will change their laws to allow me to do what I'm doing, to have monopolies?
Right. And, in other words, yes. In other words,
and New Jersey said, we'll do that, and he moved to New Jersey.
So what? Exactly correct. What did he do? He looked to the government. Exactly.
That's to allow him to allow him to monopolize markets.
That
it was
correct.
Because it was the government that was trying to say, no, you can't have a monopoly. There has to be competition. The Sherman antitrust law is a pro-competition law. Without the government, you're not going to have competition in a marketplace. You're going to have monopoly.
Absolutely not. Sherman antitrust law is one of the worst offenders of free market regulation that's ever existed. The free market itself is, if you are someone like myself who is distrustful of corporations, the free market is a much more definitive and precise.
How can you have a free market with no rules other than whoever has the most money makes the rules?
It wouldn't operate like that. As I said, the key fact here is allow ease.
Well, give me an example, Anthony, of any time in any country in the history of the world where your free market has worked that I could look at.
The United States of America is the best example of them all. Now, I understand it wasn't an anarcho-capitalist.
Are you talking about the Gilded Age? The Rockefeller era? That was the worst depression in the history of the United States. Was from 1780 to 1798. I mean, Christopher Freeland wrote a brilliant book that you'd probably find fascinating called Plutocrats. You know, Christopher Freeland, the former editor for Financial Times. Anthony, I don't think that's a good example. But keep looking. If you find something, give me a call. A period in time. I don't think that's ever been done, because I don't think it can be done outside of pure barter economies. And even then, you have to have some rules. I'll talk about it after the break. Anthony, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
A marketplace without referees is like a football game without referees. It doesn't work. Occupying the media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, a lot going on, a lot that we've talked about here. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Just listening to your previous caller, Judy. I think she's spot on. We've got a neighbor a few houses down, and they put some solar panels on the roof. And, you know, they got a pool, and there was around $400 a month, basically. Well, that was summertime, but she told me they're breaking even. So
yeah.
It's a good thing.
Yeah.
One thing I'd like to kind of go over here is we've got a water issue here. We live a little bit outside the city of Phoenix,
mm-hmm.
Okay, and our water bill, you know, for my wife and myself, it's run around $97 to $100 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's, you know, 4,000 to 7,000 gallons, and it don't matter. It only varies pennies, you know, between that, you know, a couple bucks, you mm-hmm. know, if it's between that. Okay, our private entity here wants to raise the water. The water rates, 37%.
You have a private for-profit water corporation?
Yes, sir. Indeed. And so you couple that on there, you're looking at, you know, $1.37 a month, $137.
Yeah.
Now, onto that, we have private garbage through Waste Management,
mm-hmm.
who also, by the way, sponsor the Phoenix Open.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when's the last time you heard of a garbage company sponsoring a golf tournament?
Well, if they own a monopoly, they've got you by the proverbial fill-in-the-blank.
Indeed, indeed. So we're looking at here $152 a month
mm-hmm.
for water and garbage.
Right.
Now, our friends in Phoenix, in the city of Phoenix, they've got city of Phoenix water and they have city of Phoenix garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, you know, a bill here, and in fact, even faxed it to me last year because I saw it,
mm-hmm.
and it was for $69 for the month.
Right.
And that included the trash and the water.
Right, and this comparable size house, comparable neighborhood?
Yep, you know, about, in fact, our house is a little bit bigger. And we don't have a pool,
right.
You know. I can add that, too. In fact, we used to live about four blocks from them when we lived in the city of Phoenix, and we had a pool. And ours was about that, so it really hasn't gone up yet.
Right.
You know, so I'm almost going to be paying double for what goes on.
Right. Well, hey, you got to pay for it. The stockholders have to earn a dividend in a private corporation. The CEO has to make his couple million dollars, and you got to pay for the private jet and the gold faucets in the bathroom and the little, you know, the flight attendant who brings the meal to the executive while he's at 30,000 feet. And you know, you gotta pay for the advertising and the salespeople and all those other things that it takes to make a corporation work.
Yeah, it's a great gig if you can get it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, if you can get it on a monopoly, then
yeah,
absolutely. And this is where I don't understand why the libertarians don't jump on this and clearly define. And this is where I blame the billionaires funding the libertarian think tanks. Because,
oh, sure.
Because it, you know, if the populist libertarians, like the guy who called in earlier and you know, felt that he really understood it and he really had it, if those folks were to say, okay, we're all in favor of a free market and the free market should not include the commons, and here's what we define as the commons, because this is the thing that the libertarian, you know, it's a conversation that is almost you can't have, you know, in libertarian circles. They don't want to talk about the commons. Okay, let's agree that they will say the commons are the police and the army and the judge and the court system to prevent fraud. And I would say, well, no, wait a minute. You know, our schools, our roads, our, you know, anything that is a natural monopoly, a water supply, septic supply, electric supply, these things are the things that somebody shouldn't be making a buck off of. We should collectively be administering for the good of all of us, for the public good. in a way that is well done. And you know, history demonstrates that that can be done. And not just the history of the United States. I mean, history of countries all over the world. And then, you know, let the market go crazy in other areas. Although, I do think that we should say, you know, the natural tendency of capitalism, and this is where Karl Marx's analysis in Das Kapital was absolutely spot on, even though his prescription, I think, was wrong. The natural tendency of capitalism is to monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why back in the 1920s, I forget her name, Marie somebody or other, invented the game Monopoly, was to show the dangers of laissez-faire capitalism, because it was being promoted so aggressively by Warren Harding and his administration, you know, when he ran for president in 1920 on the platform of less government and business, more business and government. And it's just so anyhow, Steve, I got to move along. But thank you for the call. Very well said. And excellent point. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Sure. First, two quick facts. First, the first message sent on ARPANET was LOL because LO failed and login had to be resent. And two,
oh, really?
Solyndra failed. Yeah. And but Solyndra failed because it went up against government-sponsored solar panel manufacturers that other countries had already exploited. So you could have inflated it all you wanted to. It
failed because of state capitalism in China.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I originally called for was because you had a guest on yesterday on the big picture that really got me thinking, because I drive through some pretty impoverished neighborhoods every day. And I think that on my way home, I go out of my way to do it because I just love and admire the resilient and old school regal architecture of the 1930s and 40s. And a lot of these structures are so beautiful and they're simply breathtaking, except they're boarded up in bad disrepair, surrounded by impoverished desperation. I mean, desperation mm-hmm. on a level where having a firearm could maybe make the difference between eating or starving. And there is one thing I see in every single one of these neighborhoods that have in common. There is only one thing I see that ties all of these stories together. There's a local warehouse, a factory, a small local larger business that you can see that's just completely boarded up and for sale by a bank.
Right.
And now you were talking about prisons earlier, right?
Well, hang on just a second. Just for our listeners, and we're going to hit the music in just a second. So for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about, the guest that we had on the program said that for every that as wages go down, gun crime goes up, and a 15% decrease in wages was producing something like a 25 or 30% increase in gun crimes and in gun homicides and gun violence. And they did this study with the Chicago area, and they found that the lower the wages were, the higher the murder rate was. Marty, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our third hour of the Tom Hartman Program here, the True People's Media. You know, as an American citizen, assuming that you are one, if you're not, if you become one, and speaking as one, you and I do not have the right as in, you know, constitutional right, we do not have the right to vote for President of the United States. I think that sounds pretty extreme. Well, just ask the five right-wingers of the Supreme Court in 2000 who decided the infamous Bush v. Gore case. In their decision, Justices Kennedy, O'Connor, Rehnquist, he was the Chief Justice, Scalia, and Thomas, and they're still with us, said right out loud in front of God and everybody that, quote, the individual citizen has no federal constitutional right to vote for electors for the President of the United States, end of quote. So how did that happen? Well, unlike U.S. representatives and senators, the President of the United States is not directly elected by we the people. Instead, the framers put it in the Constitution that the President is elected by the Electoral College. And the states can each decide how their electoral votes are divvied up. And in all but two states, whoever wins the majority of votes in a state wins all of that state's electoral votes. So even though there have been a few cases where one candidate got more votes nationally, like Al Gore getting 500,000 more votes nationwide than George W. Bush, that was the exception to the rule. Generally, the winner of the national popular vote also wins the Electoral College. And, of course, because the Constitution says that the Electoral College vote decides who's our president, that's a pretty important thing. Which is why now that the Republican Party has been hijacked by a small group of cranky billionaires, that party is trying to rig the Electoral College in what have historically been blue or Democratic voting states. This is they're really getting close to pulling this thing off. And I predict that this, you know, you're going to see at least three states, probably five, do this by the 2014 elections. But if you dial back to 2010, in the first election after the Citizens United decision, hundreds of millions of dollars in outside spending by billionaires like the Koch brothers put Republicans in control of these traditionally blue states that they had been targeting for years, including Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Michigan. And once Republicans got charge, and I would add Wisconsin to that as well, once Republicans, and arguably Indiana, once Republicans got charge of those state legislatures, they gerrymandered the congressional districts, and in fact, you could probably toss in Florida, to increase the number and the safety of the Republican seats. And that's why right now Republicans control the House of Representatives, even though nationwide House Democratic candidates received more than 1 million votes more than House Republican candidates around the nation last November. Nationally, the Republicans lost the House, but they still control it because of their election rigging at the state level. And now they want to rig the election for president of the United States. And they may well begin with Michigan. So instead of this current winner-take-all system where, you know, whoever wins the majority of the vote in the state gets all that state's Electoral College votes, Republicans want Michigan's Electoral College votes doled out based on which presidential candidate won each congressional district, with two extra votes, the extra two votes going to the state's popular vote winner. Republicans in Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia are considering similar changes, and Republican Party officials, including RNC Chair Rentz Priebus, have thrown their support behind this idea of rigging the presidential elections in the blue states. Now, they don't want to do it in the red states because then, you know, the red states go all for the Republican, and you can't, and then, geez, some Democrats might pick up electoral votes. But if they can pull this thing off, it may be a long time before a Democrat is ever elected president again, even though the majority of Americans will vote for Democrats over and over and over again for president. For example, President Obama swept the six main battleground states, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin, in the last election. And since each state operates on a winner-take-all basis, the president got all 106 electoral votes out of those six battleground states. Romney got zero. But if this new election rigging scheme had been in place last year, then President Obama would have only gotten 47 electoral college votes from the battleground states, while Mitt Romney would have won those states with 59 votes, even though he got hammered in the popular vote in each one of those states. Mitt Romney lost each state. And if all the states in the nation had gone along with this election rigging scheme that the Republicans are proposing right now in Michigan and Virginia and Pennsylvania, then billionaire Mitt Romney would be our president today, even though he lost the national vote by almost 3 million votes. I mean, here's the bottom line. These guys have this thing figured out. The billionaires and the Republicans that they own know that they are a minority in this country. Their hard right bigotry toward gays and women turns off young voters and female voters, they're and gay voters, of course. Their xenophobia and their mistrust of non-whites have turned off the growing minority electorate. And their economic principles, from Reaganomics to austerity, to trickle-down economics, they're slowly destroying our country, and the people have figured this out. So, you can't win an election fair and square, you rig it. And we have to do something to head off this billionaire takeover of our presidential elections. So what do we do? I suggest more democracy. There is a way to eliminate the power of the Electoral College that doesn't require amending the Constitution. See, because the Electoral College is in the Constitution, if you want to just take it out and say, you know, whoever gets the majority of the votes, that's the president, you'd actually have to amend Article 2 of the Constitution. But you can get around it. Pretty straightforward. You replace the Electoral College with a system of more democracy, a national popular vote that elects our president based on which candidate gets the most votes nationwide. Plain and simple, and more importantly, Republican rig-proof. 9 states have already passed national popular vote laws. And in those states, they're still doing winner-take-all right now, but what they have committed by law is that their electors, their members of the Electoral College, will vote for whichever candidate wins the national popular vote, even if that candidate lost in that state's Electoral College, in that state, and therefore should have lost that state's Electoral College vote. Now, the states that have done this so far include, there's 9 states. There's 6 small states, plus California, Illinois, and Maryland. They account for 132 electoral votes. That's almost half of the 270 needed in the Electoral College to win the presidency. If the national popular vote movement continues to spread and enough states sign up to bring their combined Electoral College votes to 270, then the Electoral College will be functionally dead, along with Republican efforts to rig our elections and corrupt our democracy. This needs to be our game plan from here on out. It's up to us, the 99%, to push back against this nation's corrupt conservative minority and their billionaire backers and stop them once and for all from rigging elections in America. So you can join this movement. Go to nationalpopularvote.com, and I have nothing to do with the people who are running this website. It's just a really, it's a great aggregation of the information on this. Nationalpopularvote.com. There's several other sites out there that talk about it as well. You can just Google it, National Popular Vote, or Dr. Goet. And see how you can get involved. Because we need democracy to push back against the billionaire-funded Republican agenda. Because it's all about corrupting democracy, and that's not a good thing in this here republic. I'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, what do you think? The Republicans going to pull this thing off? Are they going to rig the next presidential election? I think they're really going to take a shot at it. Welcome back, fair and only slightly unbalanced. That's me, Tom Hartman. Jerry in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, on the sequestration issue, the real agenda, in my opinion, of Republicans and Libertarians is to play let's make a deal and to hope that President Obama is in such a panic to make a deal that he'll actually shoot Santa Claus, so to speak, and also shoot the Democratic Party in the foot by politically horse trading cuts and changes to Social Security and Medicare in exchange for avoiding the sequester-related spending cuts.
And I agree that that's their strategy, and in fact, he kind of telegraphed he was willing to do that with the chain CPI, and I think it's a huge mistake. But I absolutely agree with you, Jerry, and we'll see. We will see. He's starting to push back. He's starting to get the populist wind behind him. Hopefully he'll wake it up. Nathan in Hood River, Oregon. Hey, Nathan. What's on your mind?
Tom, I have to disagree with you on the Soviet Union being communistic. It's basically it was a state capital system instead of communistic.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Okay, because and also we really owe the Soviet people a huge thanks for the way they handled Chernobyl and winning World War II. Basically, 7 out of 8 Germans died on the Eastern Front.
Yeah,
they're not recognized for anything they've done really, but Chernobyl especially is the. They did a great job
in fixing it. Or a lot of people died, but you could argue that they didn't do such a great job in building that place in the first place and running it.
Yeah.
I mean, I was there in Germany the week after Chernobyl melted down. It was pretty damn scary.
Yeah. It, of course it was their fault too, but, the other thing is the, lady that you had on earlier forgot to mention that nuclear is too cheap to meet her. I mean, I don't know what she's smoking, but I'm 100 miles down river of Hanford nuclear waste dump.
Oh, my.
And how do you put a price on that kind of a problem?
Right.
And that, they're finally admitting that that place is leaking like a sieve.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I'm out windsurfing, I make sure I don't blow my jibes because I don't want to be in that water. But it's really bad.
It's back to the externalities. You're absolutely right. Nathan, thanks for the call, and thanks for pointing it out. John in Rochester, New York. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What I'm calling about is I'm a little different than some of the people who are dislike big business or dislike government. I happen to trust government a little bit more. I'm thinking that all of these things that people depend on, their life depends on, electricity, healthcare, gasoline, that we live on a day-by-day basis and put in private ownership to control for us, should be run by the government.
I agree. With regard to the gasoline, at the very least, if we're going to have private companies doing the refining and the distribution and the sales, I think that the oil itself, when it comes out of the ground, should be owned by we the people, and we should be benefiting from that, like Alaska does. I mean, you know, let's take a lesson from Sarah Palin.
Look at the HMOs back in the 80s when they were changing HMOs. Oh, this is the greatest thing for us, privatizing the health care. So, hey, they'll take care of you better.
Yeah, that was the 70s, actually. And because Richard Nixon, you've got the White House tapes of Richard Nixon talking about how, you know, these HMOs, this is a great way to make money off health care, you know. Pretty much a verbatim quote.
We are under control of a greedy individual or individuals that we can't vote out and make changes.
Right, right. I'm with you. And that's the whole idea of a representative democratic republic, is that, you know, we're going to give the commons to our elected representatives in the hopes that they will represent our best interests. And frankly, it has been totally corrupted by the Supreme Court saying that corporations are people and money is speech. And you know, we need to undo that. Go to movetoamend.org, end of that speech. But, yeah, I'm with you, John. I'm with you. Thank you. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Got an important question. I've been watching you for years, and every time I see you in a debate with another person, you win it. And you know why, don't you?
No, I lost a debate pretty badly yesterday.
You actually use critical thinking.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
Now, the problem is, how is the planet going to survive when we have people that use critical thinking and they're trying to compromise with people that have absolutely no facts? They're talking total nonsense, and people saying, we see we have to compromise between these two points.
Right.
There's a difference between a point of view and total nonsense.
Yeah.
How are we going to survive if we keep on compromising between total nonsense and fact? You can't come to anything in between there that's going to solve any problem.
I don't disagree, and I think that that's one of the reasons why it's so important that we have independent media in the United States, and that we have, you know, the opportunity to educate people, and that we work really, really hard to make sure that our public school system is insulated from the influence of for-profit corporations that are corruptible and that also have allies in other for-profit corporations. We need what Jefferson referred to, an informed and educated electorate. You can't have a small D democracy in a small R republic without it. And that's why I think we should have free college education for everybody as well, or anybody who wants it. Steve, thank you for the call. Good point. Jeff in Fort Lauderdale. Got a minute to the break. Jeff, what's up? Oil companies?
Hey, Tom. Yes, I was saying that all the oil companies seem to put profit before safety. They don't seem to improve a refinery until it blows up. And then we've got the Department of the Interior is supposed to collect money from them for the leases on the drilling rights, and they refuse to collect the money. So how is our government supposed to not be in deficit if they don't even collect the fees that they're supposed to collect?
Yeah, I don't know about the fee collection part, Jeff. I just... I can't speak to that. I don't know about that. But with regard to the refineries, I mean, basically what these companies are doing is what companies arguably are required by law to do, which is put profit above everything else. Corporations are by definition sociopaths. And that's why you need society to rein them in somewhat, you know, thus government regulation. Thanks for calling, Jeff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And one of our callers today is going to get a copy of Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back, autographed by me via Stamps.com. The good, the bad, and the very, very helminthophobically ugly. The good, Art Bouvier. Art is the owner of an Indiana Cajun restaurant, and last week he changed a teenager's life. Art noticed 18-year-old Hakeel Reagan walking 10 miles in the snow on the way to a job interview for a minimum wage job at Dairy Queen. Reagan's mother died 2 years earlier, and he was desperate to find work to help support his brothers and sisters. So Art stepped up to help and offered Reagan a job at his restaurant, making double what he would have made at Dairy Queen. Reagan accepted and immediately started work this week and is working on getting a new apartment closer to the restaurant. Lately, we've seen a lot of so-called job creators screw their workers by taking away health care benefits and squeezing whatever profits they can out of their employees. It's nice to see someone doing the opposite and actually helping their workers. The bad. Jamie Dimon. The J.P. Morgan Chase CEO said something very telling at an investors conference today, admitting that his bank actually benefits from downturns. Yes, those were his words. It's true. Since the financial crisis wiped out millions of middle-class Americans, Dimon's bank has received billions in bailouts and subsidies, and executives like Jamie Dimon are doing just fine. Wall Street makes money off predatory capitalism, off devouring the middle class and small businesses, the two things needed for a dynamic, thriving economy. So naturally, when the middle class and the economy as a whole are suffering, banksters like Jamie Dimon are raking in the big bucks. Time to undo the Wall Street industrial complex, kick gamblers like Dimon out to pasture, and make banking the boring and useful industry it used to be once again. And the very, very ugly Republican Congressman Steve Stockman. While most of us sympathize with victims of gun violence, Congressman Stockman believes they are, quote, useful idiots. That's what he said this week in a YouTube interview with nutcase Ted Nugent. Referring to the gun violence victims President Obama invited to the State of the Union, Stockman asked of Nugent, do you feel that the people that Obama has brought forward to hear his speech are useful idiots or props? Yes, a sitting congressman just called victims of gun violence in America useful idiots. When it comes to gun violence in America, there's insensitivity, which is the Republican Party not holding a vote on new gun control. There's insanity, which best describes gun nuts like Nugent and Wayne LaPierre. And then there's just downright ugliness, and that's where Congressman Steve Stockton fits in, insulting those who've suffered more than he can imagine. Republican Congressman Steve Stockman is very, very ugly. Well, he's not personally ugly, but his, you know what I mean. Mike in Waukegan, Illinois, listening on WCPT out of Chicago. Hey, Mike, you got a question about libertarian paradises?
Yeah, Tom, but before I get to it, I just want to say, isn't gun violence one of them their tautologies?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I want to also mention, you know, you about John Stossel, you know, mocking global warming by taking a cold day and then using that as the norm. You know, a lot of these conservatives do that. You know, and I saw a graph here on one of those programs about global or climate change, and it was a line graph, and it was like someone it was a side view of someone walking from left to right up a flight of stairs while flipping a yo-yo. That's what it looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, it kept up and down, but it was going. It was the graph was from about the mid 20th century till now. That would have been. You follow what I'm saying?
Sort of. I can't. I yeah.
Okay. Yeah. In other words, the up and down, but as it's going up and down, it's also trending upward at the same time. So.
Okay. And the it was anyway. Again.
Pardon me?
The it that was trending was.
Well, it was like someone flipping a yo-yo up and down, walking.
No. What's the it that you're referring to?
The what?
The it that you're referring to. Are you talking about unemployment? Are you talking about wealth? Are you
climate change.
Climate change. Words, oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got it.
In other words, and I think that's a lot more comprehensive than
sure.
a cold, you know.
Sure. Yeah. It's the old hockey stuff.
I guess I didn't explain it very clearly.
No, you did. I just missed a word there. I got distracted for a second. Anyhow, how would this, you wanted to talk about libertarian paradises. Let's get right to it.
Well, yeah, okay. Now you take your profit for your prison private industrial complex, and you have your drug war, which would end under libertarians. Now, what would they use for fodder? You know, the prison system.
I think in a libertarian paradise, a private prison system would be. Fairly self-limiting because you wouldn't have the government having the ability to criminalize very much.
Yeah.
And so they're, you know.
Yeah, they would have a hard time finding.
I mean, it's actually, yeah, it's actually one of the things.
It might work out. Even,
yeah.
You,
you know, just because a clock is stopped doesn't mean it's not right twice a day. But the problem is, again, If there are no restrictions whatsoever on the behavior of corporations, capitalism always tends to monopoly. You will end up with giant corporations, and when those corporations, as Thomas Jefferson pointed out so eloquently, that you know wealth will reach a point where it is a threat to a free state. And when that happens, those private and frankly, I'd say that we're past that point right now. Those private prisons will begin figuring out a way to corrupt legislators. And have them make laws, and your libertarian paradise is going to fall apart. It's one of the essential flaws of libertarian philosophy is that there is no flywheel mechanism built into it because they do not believe in the ability of government to do anything right. And so you hand everything over to the billionaires, and then ultimately they will capture all the business, and then they will capture government. And frankly, I think that that's you know the direction that we're heading right now. Mike, thanks for the call. Jay in Chicago. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, how's it going? Good discussion. You know what? This is somewhat related. I want to throw this at you. You know, I'm doing a case study in Chicagoland. I'm noticing this confluence of cameras being erected, not the red light cameras, which probably is a part of this whole Big Brother thing in my estimation, but white cylindrical cameras that go on the top of the streetlights. Now, I've checked thoroughly into this. I see them in obscure places. I see them next to cornfields.
These are surveillance cameras.
Right, but the rationale, here's what they're tied to, and this is what's interesting. We've got to look at the symbiosis between the government and the corporation. So when we look at this thing, we're talking about a program. It's actually congestion mitigation funds this. So I looked into a village, Aurora, right outside of Chicago, and I noticed in the dilapidated sections of town where they're not doing any more community rebuilds or development, and it's, you know, there's a casino there, and it's run down, and the crappy area, these cameras are going up in every intersection through that district. So my question would be, well, you know, guys, there's no money to do anything, but you guys have the money for these cameras.
It's cheaper policing.
Supposedly for, I'm sorry?
I think it's cheaper policing. I think it's less expensive to put cameras on every corner than to have cops walk the beat. And
well, I found out these are $25,000 an intersection. I mean, they're spending a lot of money on this, but
it's a $25,000 is a one-time expense for something that presumably will last many years. So, and that's a lot less expensive than a police officer.
Oh, right, but the police officer is paid for by the village, not the federal government. The federal government's funding 95% of this.
Oh, really?
Okay, and that's,
so this is all going into the giant NSA database kind of thing that's in that building that they're building out in Utah or wherever it is.
Conceivably, all I know is I've asked the questions. So imagine the government sends out the consultant. They talk to the guy at the village who, hey, this is great. You mean I can monitor stuff from home?
Mm.
And I met with this guy, and he let me come in there. and we zoomed in from one intersection a mile away to the next intersection, and I could see it clear as day. We're looking right into a McDonald's together, and, you know, I'm kind of placating the guy by laughing along with him how great it is, and my antennas are going up, hackles are going up. The point was to get in there and see what this program was about. So these guys are engineers that are convinced, you know, it's all for the common good. But I, you can go on the expressway. Every mile, there's a globe camera with a dedicated pole. I mean, this is, so the question comes down to, okay, there's the Big Brother aspect, but who's, where's this money coming from if we're to be frugal and cut costs and the budgets need to be slashed, and in their face, they're putting these up? And that's my question. And there's a lot of deception here.
Yeah. There is virtually no limit to funding for, quote, security in the United States. And this is something that, you know, I was ranting about yesterday when I was talking about our security theater at our airports. What is a fundamentally good idea? I mean, having reasonable and rational security at our airports, when it turns into, you know, groping 3-year-olds, you know, or 7-year-olds in a that are wheelchair bound, or you know, 40-year-old cancer patients making her unwrap her bandages in front of God and everybody. I mean, it starts to disintegrate. The whole thing starts to disintegrate. And when you start getting these Chertoff porno X-ray machines, you know, so that Michael Chertoff can make millions, and we can actually get more of us die from cancer than, you know, in a 10-year period than died from 9/11, and just caused by the X-ray machines at the airports. And that's, you know, according to the TSA statistics. I mean, it's like what? At some point, you got to say, you know, this is nuts. But there is no limit to the funding for if you call it national security, they will come up with money for it, and a lot of it's coming out of budgets that do not have transparent line item expenditures associated with them. So that's the problem. Jay, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Well, this is interesting. Simon in Minneapolis thinks we should not go to a national popular vote. We'll have that conversation in just a few minutes. Exposing the con and conservative. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Simon in Minneapolis listening to KTNF. Hey, Simon, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to talk about the whole Electoral College thing.
Yeah, you don't think that we should have a national popular vote?
No. I think that I think the founders wanted more of a representative democracy. Now, I think that the current system we have is not, you know, the best, and I think it can be. The Republicans can change it and finagle it the way they want. I think what we should have is each state should have its own percentage-based electoral vote of representatives that would then elect the president, electors that would then elect the president.
Why go through that fancy little two-step, though? I mean, the states already have electors. The number of electors they have is the number of members of the House plus the two senators. When that was originally hatched, that idea was originally hatched, Jefferson was basing it on the Wittgemeinschaft, the old council of wise elders from the Whig histories that he read about England before the invasion of the Italians, the Roman Empire, before the Roman Empire took England. His ancestors, Jefferson's ancestors, particularly the redheaded people, he had red hair, were, you know, lived tribally. And once a year, people from tribes all over the islands, all over the British Isles, would get together and they would have this council. And local communities would elect the wise elders to go to this council and select the, you know, make decisions for the community. And Jefferson just thought that was a fine idea. And let's use something like that. Let's create a council of wise elders to elect the president. Because electors do not have to vote for who the people who voted for them vote. You know, I mean, they literally can make up their own mind and vote for anybody for president because they're supposed to be the Council of Wise Elders. And I can see where that made a certain amount of sense back in the 1780s when it was a 3-day ride from Georgia up to Washington, D.C., or up to New York when the seat of government was in New York originally. And so, hey, you know, we're in the community in Georgia. Let's just find the, you know, the person that we trust the most, and we'll send that person off to the Capitol, and they'll make a decision. for the president. But it seems like it's an anachronism. It's really outdated now.
Yeah, I guess to me it seems like the Electoral College functions as instead of having the, you know, the Congress and the Senate together elect the president, that it's sort of a stepwise every 4 years election of a president, which I prefer. But I still think that each state should be able to individually decide and still give some amount of power and authority to the states, just like we do with having two representatives in the Senate, as opposed to a strict popular representative.
Why?
In the House.
Why?
I think that the people who are in the minority deserve to be able to have their voices heard when it counts for.
But when those small states were calling themselves the minority, when Delaware and Rhode Island were saying, hey, we're small states, we're not going to join the Confederation of States because, you know, we operated under the Articles of Confederation for the first few years. We're not going to join this thing, or we're not going to, you know, the Constitution for that matter. We're not going to join the United States unless we have a little larger voice than would be warranted by our population. At that point in time, they were basically operating as sovereign nations that were joining a compact whose principal purpose was trade. I mean, that was the Articles of Confederation, was basically a giant, you know, free trade agreement among the states. And that's no longer the case. Individual states are not that sovereign. And the extent to which they are, you could argue, I think, fairly cogently that there's not necessarily good outcomes. Can you give me an example of where? Well, actually, you know, Bernie would say we should be doing health care in the individual states. That there's still an argument to be made for some state sovereignty. I'm arguing here with myself. Sorry, Simon. But I don't get why, you know, if like, you know, in 2000, Al Gore got 500,000 more votes nationwide than George W. Bush did. Why wasn't he president?
Yeah, I agree the Electoral College as it sits is not a functioning system. And obviously the minority right now in terms of those more rural states that would gain the benefit of any more representative, individually.
Well, they get the advantage of the Electoral College.
Right. I feel that they should get some small advantage because in that extent their voices are heard more. Now, granted, right now I don't think that the people who are in charge in those states are necessarily the best people to be calling the shots.
So the flip side of that, though, is you're telling people in California, New York, and Texas and Florida that their voice should be less loud when it comes to who's president. And, you know, who are you to say that?
I mean, I'm not personally, but
no. But I mean, what's the rationale for that? What purpose could you lay out for that?
Because those electors that are elected by the states, just the same thing as in the Senate. And I understand that the argument about the colonies entering into free trade and all that, but those states that entered into that compact are still members in that compact today.
Right.
And I think the system does need to be changed, but I think that in the case of those individual electors, as they represent a portion of their own state, that state should have more of a say over who those electors are.
Simon, let me give you an argument for the Electoral College that you might like. The main reason not to have a national popular vote is because with a national popular vote, since we have some cities that are so large, you could and they're major media markets where you can make a media buy and hit everybody in the city. The entire presidential campaign could be done in basically 20 cities, and the concerns of rural people could be completely ignored. And the Electoral College at least forces a conversation about things like farm programs and rural people. Simon, Shano tells me you're the guy who's going to get a copy of Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People, and How You Can Fight Back. Simon is on line one, Danielle. And coming up tomorrow on the program, it's an issue that has some progressives as well as libertarians concerned about our privacy rights, biometric ID. Ever heard about it? We'll be talking with Chris Calabrese of the ACLU and David Beers of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.